This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, it's wonderful news to announce that Russell Maroon Schotz has been removed from solitary confinement. After 22 years, the 70-year-old former Black Panther has finally been able to hug his children. Attorney Brett Grody gives us an overview of the work that went into reversing a long-standing injustice. We'll talk about the Vatican's response to being called before the United Nations Committee on the Rights of the Child.
Even those of us who had high hopes that the Vatican would be hit hard for its role in the sexual violence against hundreds of thousands were surprised by just how hard the committee went after the Vatican.
Stay with us.
City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Today we'll be talking a bit about the use of solitary confinement in U.S. prisons. On a related note, last week the National Lawyers Guild submitted testimony to a Senate Judiciary Subcommittee hearing on solitary confinement in U.S. prisons, jails, and also in detention centers. The testimony outlined the psychiatric, social, and also the economic damage wrought by the use of this punishment, which, as we've discussed before, is a clear violation of domestic and international law. The hearing was called Reassessing Solitary Confinement 2, the Human Rights, Fiscal, and Public Safety Consequences. It was chaired by Senator Dick Durbin, who had also chaired the first ever congressional hearing on the subject in June 2012. As we've discussed before, and as the Guild noted in its testimony, we hope that solitary confinement will be an obsolete and wholly unnecessary practice. That will happen when our government dedicates itself to eliminating racism from the criminal justice system and instead places more emphasis where it should, namely on rehabilitation, treatment for addiction, safe and effective reentry programs, and helping with housing and employment. Also last week, a coalition of more than three dozen privacy groups, including the National Lawyers Guild, urged the White House to push for privacy legislation. It's actually been 2 years since President Obama introduced the so-called Consumer Privacy Bill of Rights, which would call for a federal law codifying privacy protections in the U.S. In the group's letter, they noted that, quote, "the key to progress is the enactment by Congress of this important privacy framework, and that only enforceable privacy protections create meaningful safeguards." Groups endorsing the letter included the Electronic Privacy Information Center, the ACLU, the American Library Association, and the Center for Digital Democracy. They noted that self-regulation has not worked in protecting consumers, and that it's crucial to codify the Consumer Privacy Bill of Rights to create what they call baseline standards for the development of innovative services that take advantage of technology while safeguarding privacy. Citing revelations of government surveillance and recent data breaches, the letter stressed the urgency of updating our privacy laws, especially with respect to curtailing the extent that data aggregators, such as Axiom and other large groups, amass information on consumers for marketing purposes. Turning now to court developments on mass spying on Muslims, last week a federal judge in New Jersey dismissed a lawsuit brought by Muslims in that state asserting that the NYPD investigated and monitored them based on little more than their Muslim faith. The plaintiffs in Hassan v. City of New York have indicated their plans to appeal. The court in Hassan blamed plaintiffs' injuries on disclosures made by the Associated Press about the spying, rather than on the NYPD's conduct. And the court accepted the police argument that they were seeking to prevent terrorism, once again, in finding that the plaintiffs' claims of discrimination weren't plausible, ignoring the unconstitutional way in which the NYPD pursued their goal. The Hassan lawsuit challenges the NYPD policy and practice of religious profiling. It asserted that the NYPD deliberately and improperly used religion instead of criminal suspicion, and in doing so, violated the Constitution's guarantee of equal protection by going out and looking only for Muslims rather than directing its spying at prospective terrorists. By focusing on the NYPD's stated goal rather than its method, the court in Hassan runs counter to a narrow view of discrimination that many other courts have rejected, and it suggests that discrimination violates the Constitution only if based on explicit prejudice traditionally associated with things like school segregation or the denial of voting rights. In this case, we believe the court should have applied the test of whether a police policy or practice targets persons based on their race, religion, or other constitutionally protected status, regardless of whether that discrimination was part of the police's original goal. In addition to engaging in discriminatory practices, the police's reliance on religion instead of criminal suspicion stigmatizes entire communities and is ineffective from a public safety point of view. In our final update, it is with a heavy heart that we report that Chokwe Lumumba, mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, has passed away at the age of 66. He was an attorney with a long record of black radical and human rights activism who was able to persuade local voters to accept a sales tax to repair the failing infrastructure of Mississippi's capital city. Lumumba served one term on the city council and was sworn in as mayor this past July. He was one of two candidates who defeated then-Mayor Harvey Johnson, Jr. in the Democratic primary and went on to defeat businessman Jonathan Lee in the general election. In 2011, Lumumba persuaded then-Governor Haley Barbour, a Republican, to release sisters Jamie Scott and Gladys Scott from a Mississippi prison after having served 16 years for an armed robbery they say they didn't commit. As mayor, Lumumba persuaded Jackson voters to pass a referendum in January to add a 1 cent local sales tax to help pay for improvements to crumbling roads and the aging water and sewer system. Mourners, both Democrats and Republicans alike, noted that Lumumba's administration and his personal enthusiasm had provided a ray of much-needed hope for so many, saying that he was just beginning to make an effective start in tackling the long-neglected challenges of the city. Lumumba was involved with the Republic of New Africa in the 1970s and 80s. The group advocated reparations for slavery and was watched, as were many others, by an FBI counterintelligence operation. In 1990, when the Ku Klux Klan planned to march through Jackson, Lumumba organized counter-demonstrators, including a predominantly white group of Millsaps College students. Chokwe Lumumba is in our thoughts and leaves behind an enduring legacy and model of civil and human rights activism. Law and Disorder, we've been keeping you updated on the campaign to release Russell Maroon Schoetz from solitary confinement. We're heartened at last to broadcast the news that he was recently released from solitary and is now in the general prison population. Maroon has spent 40 years in the U.S. prison system, and 22 of those years under intense lockdown, allowed only 1 hour a day outside of his cell. In May 2013, Maroon brought a lawsuit on the grounds that he was subjected to cruel and unusual punishment in violation of the Eighth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, and that he was denied his legal rights to proceed with the case. We're joined today by attorney Brett Grody, a member of the Russell Maroon Schoetz legal team and the Abolitionist Law Center. Welcome back, Brett, to Law and Disorder.
Thanks, Heidi. Thanks for having me.
The day has come when we're finally so happy to have you with us because we have wonderful news to report about Russell Maroon Schoetz, and he's finally out of solitary. Remind listeners who Russell Maroon Schotz is.
Russell Maroon Schotz is a political prisoner, former Black Panther, who has been held in solitary confinement, or was held in solitary confinement, in the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections without break from 1983 till just last week. There was a brief time he was in the federal system for 17 months, but since he was returned in 1991 to Pennsylvania, he'd been held in solitary confinement until last Thursday. And last Thursday, February 20th, we had a legal phone call scheduled to take place that morning when we received notice from the prison that the housing unit that he was in, the restricted housing unit, was not going to be able to facilitate that phone call because he was no longer on the unit. So after a few more phone calls and attempting to, you know, set up an opportunity to talk with Maroon, I received a call from him at 1 p.m. confirming that he had been released from solitary confinement just hours before that very morning. You know, we notified his family, notified the world, and that same night, he actually had his first contact visit in more than 20 years when his son, Russell III, and his daughter, Sharon, were able to go see him. And there's a really wonderful picture of the three of them that's circulating on the internet. You can find it on the Abolitionist Law Center's website, abolitionistlawcenter.org. But this was the first time Maroon had had a contact visit in more than 22 years, the first time he was able to embrace his son in that long, and actually the first time he was able to embrace Sharon in more than 30 years, as she wasn't able to make it to Leavenworth when he was in the federal penitentiary there in 89 to 91.
Brett, what factors contributed to securing Russell's release from solitary?
You know, I cannot speak for the prison, but I can speak of the kind of constellation of forces and various tactics and strategies that had been deployed over a course of 3 years, essentially, of a renewed, reinvigorated effort to get Maroon out of solitary confinement. And it started back in August of 2010 when State Representative Ron Waters held a hearing on solitary confinement in front of the House Judiciary Committee, and Maroon's daughter, Teresa Schotz, was there, and seeing former prisoners, seeing survivors of solitary confinement and advocates testify in the presence of DOC officials and state legislators inspired her, and she said on that very day, I remember it crystal clear, I'm going to get my dad out of solitary. And that began a series of advocacy efforts, including phone calls, including action alerts that saw the construction of a coalition of more than 30 organizations around the country, such including the National Lawyers Guild, the Center for Constitutional Rights, the Human Rights Coalition in Pennsylvania, some chapters, the American Friends Service Committee, that began letter-writing campaigns that would call in at certain times when we were led to believe Maroon was possibly being reviewed for release from solitary confinement. And also in 2012, you and I, Heidi, along with Teresa, went and had a personal visit with Secretary Wetzel discussing Maroon's case. But nothing happened. There was no change in condition or indication that anything was going to change until late March of 2013. And what had been happening at that time is Maroon had been getting increasing visits from lawyers. There were more correspondence coming from the legal team that was being created that included Dan Kovalik from the United Steelworkers, Rick Etter and Stephanie Lepore, now Stephanie Burt of Reed Smith, and Dustin McDaniel with the Abolitionist Law Center. And right on the eve, maybe about a week before, we were set to send the Department of Corrections our demand letter requesting that he be released in 30 days or else they would be hit with the civil rights lawsuit. They abruptly, without any notice that this was going to happen, transferred him from the State Correctional Institution at Green, where he had been for 18 years, to SCI Mahanoy. And since that time, within a nine-month period, he had been transferred two more times. He went from SCI Mahanoy down the road to SCI Frackville, where he completed a 60-day step-down program, which essentially consisted of him working as a block worker in the RHU for 1 hour a day, 5 days a week.
Meaning he'd come into contact with other inmates.
He would just really be on the tier, and since he was in the solitary confinement unit, he would not have contact because all the other prisoners were in their cells. This was essentially seeing if Maroon, who at this time had turned 70 years old, was capable of cleaning a shower stall or pushing a broom without violating prison rules to demonstrate he should be in general population. If it sounds a little absurd, that's because it is. He'd been pretty much free of rule violations for more than 20 years at this point, right? But this was building an administrative record and showing that Maroon was capable of negotiating his way through whatever, you know, obligations were placed upon him by prison officials. And at the end of this time, he was, you know, told that he was not going to be released into population at Frackville, but he was going to be transferred. And then upon his transfer to SCI Greater Forford, he was shortly after informed by the superintendent there that they were finally doing the complete review process, and it would take about 4 weeks to place him in population. And the whole time that this nine-month series of transfers had went on, the case of Schultz v. Wetzel was being litigated. It was filed in May, and we began briefing motion to dismiss in September and filing discovery requests shortly thereafter, and have been continuing to pursue this litigation while we have been, you know, working to see what is going to happen with his release, which just happened last week.
I heard that the prison got so many calls from concerned individuals asking for him to be released from solitary into general that they were saying, you know, stop the calls. Is that accurate?
Well, Maroon told us that he was told that, you know, this was, yeah, essentially that they wanted, that they were giving him promises, repeated promises, that you're going to be placed in population. And these phone calls are, they were telling him that they weren't helping, mm-hmm. and please stop it, and we will do what everybody is asking us to do, and that they had been planning on doing that, which in my, you know, experience 6 or so years as being a human rights advocate for prisoners in Pennsylvania, I've never heard of prison officials going to somebody in the solitary units and telling them, we're going to do what you want, right? But just tell people to back off.
Wow. Brett, let's put this in the big context. Now, clearly, there was egregious abuse of the use of solitary confinement in Russell's case. The number of years he was isolated and confined really amounts to torture. And recently, we've had the second set of hearings before the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on the use of solitary confinement. Tell us a bit about why you think solitary is in the forefront of news right now.
I would say you'd have to, you know, back up more than 30 years to whenever solitary confinement began its rise to becoming a normative practice within United States prisons. And you have to kind of understand the political logic which led to that and understand what mass incarceration's primary function is. So if any politician in this country were to stand up and give a stump speech or have a platform where they were to advocate that the solution to the worsening and chronic social problems in this country were to intensify surveillance, arrests, detention, and imprisonment of people, particularly based upon their race, particularly targeting people of color, poor people, the mentally ill, survivors of childhood abuse and trauma and sexual violence, gender nonconforming people, etc., those people who are most disproportionately targeted by policies of mass incarceration, and they were to be really explicit about that, this politician would presumably be understood as a totalitarian in the worst mold of some of the, you know, those recognized monsters from the 20th century, as a fascist. But instead they say that this is a matter of being tough on crime and that this is necessary to protect public safety, and this is the end result of policies that have been pursued for more than 30 years. And so in the context of constructing this massive imperial prison state, they have resorted to similarly punitive ideologies and tactics to manage that prison population once they're behind the walls. And that is include widespread use of solitary confinement in a way that is qualitatively different than it had been used throughout most of the 20th century. So instead of it being a short-term disciplinary measure, it was being used as a long-term affirmative strategy for managing the prison population, for warehousing people that were problematic to prison officials because maybe they filed a lot of grievances or were jailhouse lawyers, maybe they were political prisoners or dissidents, or they just had such serious mental health issues and the prison system was so strained and lacking in resources for programs and health care that it has been more convenient for officials to keep them in really psychologically torturous conditions. So there has been a groundswell building against some of the worst aspects of this system of mass incarceration, and solitary confinement has been one of those. There's been a very important report by the United Nations Special Rapporteur Juan Mendez in 2011 that was attempting to advocate for a ceiling to solitary confinement in terms of the duration and setting that at 15 days. And just to provide a little context, anybody in Pennsylvania who is sent into solitary confinement is going to have typically 30 days at least, right, for any sort of rule violation. And in the 30 years that this has been ongoing, there has been waves of activism that really at the outset were led by people like Bonnie Kernes of AFSC Prison Watch and the Committee to End the Marion Lockdown and a lot of people that were supporting the political prisoners from the liberation movements of the 70s and 80s who were, you know, some of those most heavily targeted by this. Currently, what we're seeing in the United States Senate hearings that Senator Durbin just had is a response to decades of activism and to very, you know, committed struggle by people inside of prisons and their allies to break out of the silence that's been imposed on them through these conditions of isolation.
Brett Russell spent a record number of years in solitary. He must be up there as one of the longest amounts of time. Why was this?
Well, in 1977 and 1980, Maroon liberated himself from prison, but he was recaptured both times. And so for the last 10, 15 years, he has been in solitary. He's been told, you're an escape risk and a less secure status. But in 1982, they didn't consider him such an escape risk that they had to keep him in solitary still. They released him into the general population at the state prison here in Pittsburgh. And at this point, Maroon had made a decision that he was going to abide by lawful means, abide by prison regulations, but he was, of course, going to be committed to advocating on behalf of his own human rights and interests of those other lifers who were serving a sentence to die in prison in Pennsylvania. So he became involved with the Pennsylvania Association of Lifers. In the evening, he was appointed their interim president, and the kind of old guard from a very ineffective organization was impeached. He was placed in solitary confinement and given a write-up for holding an unauthorized meeting. Now, that carries a 30-day penalty, but Maroon experienced a 30-year penalty. And I think the parallel to the case of the Angola 3 is very relevant here, in which the warden of Louisiana said that explicitly they were being held because they would practice Black Pantherism. And it's long been assumed by Maroon, by people close to him, by the many prisoners and former prisoners who have great admiration and respect for this man, that this is what is really was really motivating the Department of Corrections. But, you know, after the international outcry that saw even UN Special Rapporteur Juan Mendez advocating his release, along with five Nobel Peace laureates that former national co-chair of the campaign, Matt Meyer, was able to line up, the Department of Corrections just had too much noise coming at them from many different directions to ignore his case any longer and felt it in their own interest to finally release him.
How is Russell's state of mind? How's he feeling? How's he doing?
Well, I'm going to be paying him a visit very soon, so I can talk to him more about that then. But when I spoke to him on Thursday, I told him how happy I was to be speaking with him in these changed circumstances, and he assured me that he was happier. And I told him that many of his supporters and family members were certainly going to be shedding more than one tear tonight upon hearing of his release, and he assured me that he also would be one of them.
Unbelievable. Brett, You've done so much to draw attention to his case. Just briefly, before we let you go, tell us, what else are you working on?
Right now, the Abolitionist Law Center is continuing to pursue the litigation in Schultz v. Wetzel. The defendant's motion to dismiss was denied as to all counts. So that litigation will continue until we are assured that our client's legal interests are protected. We are also in the preparation stages of bringing a similar challenge to the 34 years of solitary confinement of Arthur Chedoweo Johnson by the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections. It's a case that's very similar to Maroon's. He has had a pretty exemplary disciplinary record for approximately 25 years, 61-year-old man who has spent more than half of his life in solitary confinement. And in addition to our solitary confinement dockets, we are litigating a First Amendment prison censorship case, and we have taken on the representation of Charmaine Fender, a Pennsylvania prisoner serving life without parole, for killing a man who was attempting to rape her. So this is where our docket is at right now, and as you can see, we're very busy.
Thank you so much. You're really an inspiration to us. It's not that often that we get a piece of good news. Of course, we wish Russell were not behind bars in general, but this is remarkable in terms of what can be done with continued pressure and dedication, the kind that you've given. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Heidi. And I would be remiss in not mentioning that the next phase is to advocate for Maroon's freedom from prison. So we'll certainly be happy to talk about that at a later date. And can't thank you enough for continuing to focus on this issue, and hope to talk to you soon.
Yes, give my best to Russell.
Certainly.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. On Law and Disorder, we continue to report on the work of the Center for Constitutional Rights and SNAP, the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, in bringing accountability within the Catholic Church for widespread sexual violence against perhaps hundreds of thousands of victims, mainly children. Recently, the Vatican was summoned before the United Nations Committee on the Rights of the Child to respond to allegations of systemic sexual violence and practices that have allowed abuse to continue. Our guest today is Pam Spies, Senior Staff Attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights. She'll tell us about the Vatican's response.
Pam, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be back with you.
I know we've covered the case before. You represent, and the Center represents, SNAP, the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. And there's some recent developments in that situation. In fact, remarkable developments in the last, compared to what's been going on in the last few years. And I know you, a couple of weeks ago, came back from Geneva. And can you tell us, give us some background on what you were doing in Geneva?
Well, we were in Geneva with members of the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, because the Vatican was actually having to report to the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child for the first time ever on the issue of sexual violence. And the reason they were doing that is because they've actually ratified the Convention on the Rights of the Child back in 1990. And I think many, many people in the Vatican and maybe even in the UN saw this ratification as largely symbolic. And I don't think really expected, certainly, you know, officials at the Vatican, I don't think ever really expected to be held accountable in the same way that other countries are when they ratify these treaties. But in a historic development last year, the committee actually called the Vatican to report, and this was in the wake of more than a decade of scandals that have broken out in different parts of the world and investigations in different countries, which really revealed that, you know, the Vatican has a system in place which actually enables and facilitates this kind of widespread sexual violence.
You mentioned that they were called before a committee. This is the enforcement arm of that treaty? Is that how it works?
That's right. The treaty basically set up a committee of experts, of independent experts, which are, their job is to oversee compliance with the treaty. And so their job is to basically review different states, different countries that have ratified this convention and, you know, help. They're basically in a dialogue with them to determine how they are in compliance with the treaty, how they're protecting children's rights,
and
how they're falling short.
And there's actually a hearing where the Vatican participates, you participate, victims participate, survivors participate. I'm not sure. Well, how does it work?
Well, the way it works is the state party, in this case the Vatican, because it's considered a state for these purposes, files a report, and they're supposed to do that periodically under, like, every 5 years under the treaty, but they were well over 10 years late in submitting a report. And then the committee reviews that report and then engages with civil society organizations like CCR and SNAP, where we submit our reports, and then they will meet with civil society. So in June, we were there with members of the Survivors Network, and we met with the committee and gave them a lot of the background that we had. And then the committee meets in a very public forum with representatives of the state party. And in this case, it was the Vatican. And it was an all-day session, over 6 hours, where they were, you know, having to answer questions that the committee was asking. And it's the first time they've had to do this. They've never had to show up and answer questions to an international body about the widespread sexual violence before. So it was a really historic moment for survivors around the world, really.
Pam, I understand that the committee charged that the Vatican hadn't cooperated fully with investigators. So when they actually sit down in a room, do Vatican representatives have attorneys present? Do they have the right to refuse to answer questions? How does that work?
Well, in the context of the committee sessions, the committee hearings, it's an open dialogue. They did have canon lawyers, Vatican lawyers, present with them, but for the most part, they, you know, there had been the back and forth reporting and the Vatican's response in writing, and then they show up in person and have to, you know, have this dialogue. So the committee had asked for data on the scope of the sexual violence, the information the Vatican has about it, what was done in these cases with individual priests, but also it was important that they also asked for information and data about the evidence of higher officials who've helped cover up these crimes in different places around the world. You know, they weren't singling the Vatican out. You know, it's the Vatican officials have come out and said that this committee was biased and was being overly harsh on the Vatican. But this is the kind of information they asked from every state party. So the Vatican was just being treated like any other member of this treaty.
I know you, on behalf of SNAP and the center, submitted information, and then I think there was a report. Can you just give us some sense of what kind of information you submitted on behalf of SNAP or SNAP submitted?
Sure. We basically gathered the findings from different commissions and that have been undertaken in different parts of the world, Ireland, Canada. There are now commissions happening in Australia. There have been commissions in Belgium and Germany. And certainly grand jury investigations here in the U.S. So there's a growing body of evidence and really conclusive findings about the magnitude and scale of the sexual violence in these places, but also the ways in which church authorities have enabled that violence and knowingly enabled it, and, you know, through covering it up, through exposing others to more harm. And, you know, Michael, one of the things we've talked about in the past is the complaint we made to the International Criminal Court. Subsequent to that filing in September 2011, where we asked a prosecutor to open an investigation into high-ranking Vatican officials for their role in creating and maintaining this system, the Survivors Network membership has more than doubled. They now have survivors as part of their network in over 70 countries.
And how many people? I mean, I think it's in the thousands, right?
It's in the thousands. And before we filed at the ICC, they had, around 12,000 in primarily in North America, but, you know, members in other countries as well, outside of the region. But now it really is a worldwide movement of survivors.
And so you submitted that evidence. And before we get to what the conclusions of the committee were, I know that since you've begun that case at the ICC and over the last couple of years, the Vatican has made, quote, efforts to try and come to grips supposedly with this crisis in the church. And I think that you've been critical of those, or SNAP has been critical of those. Can you just tell us some of what the Vatican claims it did, but what really are some of its weaknesses?
Well, the Vatican officials are claiming that this issue is a thing of the past and that they've made changes. One of the series of changes is they point to 2011, when the then Pope Benedict issued a new set of guidelines and essentially an instruction to Catholic authorities around the world that they should comply with civil laws, and that each bishop's conference in each part of the world should come up with its own set of guidelines for how they will be handling these kinds of allegations. And the problem there is that that's just the latest in a series. You know, we've seen similar types of language in policies in the U.S. We've seen similar language in Ireland. But what has happened in both the U.S. and Ireland is that Rome, officials at the Vatican, have overridden the national-level bishops' plan to require mandatory reporting of sexual violence. So the Vatican has come out, when bishops have wanted to do this at the national level, they've come out and rejected the idea of mandatory reporting, and that's still the policy. But the other problem with all of this, at the national level and at the Vatican level, is that these policies have no teeth. There is absolutely no repercussion or consequence envisioned in any of these documents for those who fail to follow the policy, so meaning the cardinals and bishops who are still shifting priests around. And I think it's important to point out that a Philadelphia grand jury, after a multi-year investigation, found in 2012 that even with what's so-called zero-tolerance policy in place, with a review board basically giving the all-clear to the archdiocese there were still 39 credibly accused priests serving openly in ministry. And the archdiocese had not been upfront about that. And it took a grand jury investigation really digging in to even learn that. So, same practices are happening behind the policies, and then the policies have no teeth. So, if I can just share one more example, if you have a bishop in Australia who is departing from church doctrine and suggesting that women should be ordained as priests, he's ousted immediately. If you have a bishop where there's a wealth of evidence, like in the case of Cardinal Mahoney, for instance, in the Los Angeles Archdiocese, a wealth of documented evidence, letters with his name on them, incontrovertible evidence that he was shifting priests out even for credibly accused, even admitted offenders, out of California for treatment, because if they'd gone for treatment in California, there was mandatory reporting. And then also we know that in that diocese that there were payments to priests to stay out of the jurisdiction while civil cases were pending. And, you know, I mean, this is the level of cover-up we're seeing. That's just an example. And yet you have Cardinal Mahoney still serving and actually helped select this latest pope.
Just to summarize, Pam, you referred to the term shifting, and what you're talking about is the practice of priest shifting, where high-ranking officials have transferred known offenders to other jurisdictions where they still have access to children.
Right. That's exactly right.
And other practices have been noted, destruction of evidence.
Right, yes. You know, we have a commission in Germany. It was noted there that there was so much documentation that had been destroyed that they couldn't get a real sense of the scale and scope of the problem in Germany. You have a former archbishop in Wisconsin who's talked about shredding, you know, documents on a routine basis and under, you know, sworn testimony, admitted to this. And, you know, we've seen other examples of that. But the pre-shifting is something that is just common. I mean, one former canon lawyer has said it's part of the DNA of the church.
Pam, I want to get to what happened with the committee. I know there's this, as you said, SNAP, CCR, submitted testimony. The Vatican answered or had a dialogue, as you said. Mm-hmm. And then the committee issued a report. And I didn't read the whole report, but I saw some of the coverage of it. And it was quite extraordinary, it seemed to me. It was front page in a lot of the papers. It seemed like a big deal. I'd like your reaction to it and what were some of the key findings in it?
Well, it was a hard-hitting report. And I think it showed the committee's, you know, the committee wasn't swayed by the Vatican's non-answers. I mean, as the day wore on at the hearing itself, and the questions just were consistently avoided, no matter how many times and how many different ways the committee asked them, I think you see a reflection of that in this report. But they very clearly got two very important things. One, they took the sexual violence seriously. They got that it's happening on a massive scale. And even more importantly, because we know sexual violence happens in, you know, can occur in every institution. But when you have a closed system like the Vatican that is saying it can police itself, and it's really not, it's actually continuing to enable, they got the way the system is operating. And that was really important for survivors to be there, and they called them out on that. And it's not just about addressing or putting the blame on individual perpetrators, right? It's about changing fundamentally the system and the way it operates. And until you start to see accountability for those officials who are continuing to enable it and cover it up, there's no fundamental change. And they got that, and that's reflected in the report. They also demanded, again, they do this with every state party to the treaty, they're still requesting the data on the crisis. And we know the Vatican has that because the Vatican has always, it is a very centralized hierarchical organization, and it has always required that these types of allegations be run through Rome, and even more so streamlined after 2001 through a particular entity in Rome. So we know they have the data. If they're serious about changing the system, if they're serious about changing the culture, transparency and accountability is key, and the committee made that point over and over.
Pam, I was interested to read that Vatican journalist John Allen wrote in the Boston Globe that the UN report might actually have a negative effect. Can you talk a bit about that?
We've seen Vatican officials come out and in sort of two waves and criticize the report. And the most recent wave, they've really focused on the committee's questions about non-discrimination issues, you know, sexual orientation and gender identity, requiring, you know, that children, minors with different sexual orientations or gender identities not be discriminated against, some, you know, issues around reproductive health. And the Vatican officials have come out and said that was the committee injecting its sort of politics and political bias into this inquiry when it should have been focused solely, if they're really serious about it, on the sexual violence. And, you know, one response to that is that if the committee had come out and focused solely on sexual violence, it would have been criticized for that, right? But the treaty is a wide-ranging treaty that sets out a number of rights that are to be protected, respected, and fulfilled by the state's parties. And, you know, the Vatican, I mean, this is one of the problems with the way the Vatican has operated, is that it has operated as a state when it's convenient, and it falls back to its religious entity status when it's not convenient to be a state. And so here you have this entity that's ratified a treaty. It's a secular treaty. There are a number of rights listed in it, and it's wanting to opt out whenever it whenever it's uncomfortable on some of these issues. But the fact of the matter is the committee had a job to do. Sexual, you know, the right to be protected from any sort of violence, and in particular sexual violence and exploitation, is a right among many in that treaty, and they were trying to do their job in terms of looking at a number of rights. So I think that's one of the things that church officials and those who are defending the church in this context are pointing to as being overreaching, when actually the committee was trying to cover other aspects of the treaty as well.
Has there been any official reaction from the Vatican?
The Vatican spokesperson in Rome has come out and spoken to this, and the reaction is that they don't feel that the committee took into account these policy changes, or didn't give enough credence to the policy changes that they're saying they've made. And, you know, the committee may not have named the policy, may not have used it in those language, but they were certainly cognizant of what the Holy See had represented and then what the critique of an analysis of that is and how it's operating on the ground. And then the other reaction is from one of the Vatican officials who was actually there and being questioned, who's the head of the mission, the Holy See's mission to the UN, you know, has been sort of suggesting that the committee has been influenced by a gay lobby and really trying to deflect attention away from, you know, the rightful and just criticisms of its handling of these issues.
Now, Pam, the Vatican is going to issue an official response to the proposals for reforms. That's forthcoming, correct?
That's what we expect, yes.
And if that's a lukewarm, tepid response, what are the next steps?
Well, as long as the Vatican remains a state party to this treaty, they are under periodic reporting obligations. We now have hope and reason to believe that the committee is going to hold them to that. Because as I said, until these last few years, I think many folks saw their ratification as symbolic and sort of soft, and you know, but they did ratify this treaty and took on the obligation. So we expect that the committee will hold them to their reporting obligations and will continue to maintain oversight and an analysis of what steps the Vatican is taking. I should say that one of the really absurd representations by the Vatican in this process was that it should only be seen as responsible for what happens within the confines of the territory of Vatican City State.
That's great. I love it.
Right. And you know, to hear them talk, they have no control over anything other Catholic institutions are doing around the world. I guess, you know, now there can be anarchy and people can depart from church policy all they want, when in fact we know that the reins are tightly held in Rome. And, you know, that position is not only inconsistent with international human rights law. When you are a causal factor in the chain of a violation, you can be held accountable. You know, the U.S. fights that principle as well, too, for extraterritorial application of human rights norms. But it also is completely disingenuous when you consider the ways in which the Church has operated to subvert justice systems and national legal systems around the world.
What are the plans now at CCR and SNAP going forward? I know you, the ICC case, as I recall, was dismissed. What are you guys thinking now for the next steps?
Well, the case wasn't dismissed. What happened was in May of last year,
Dumb Michael.
the prosecutor indicated that they would not be seeking to open an investigation at the time, but, you know, left the door open to reconsider that decision upon submission of further evidence, and also suggested pursuing remedies at national systems. And because, you know, the ICC is supposed to be a court of last resort. And we understood that going into it. Both my co-counsel and I had worked around the negotiations of the ICC, but felt that there was, and believed and had a legal analysis, that there's really no national system that's in a position to deal with the magnitude of this crime, and that you really need a global, a court with more of a global reach and the jurisdiction over crimes against humanity to try higher level officials. And they also pointed to other international organizations like the Committee on the Rights of the Child. So we still see the door as ajar there. But what's coming up next is the UN Committee Against Torture has decided to call the Holy See for review. And that will be happening in April, again in Geneva. And that's important because the Committee Against Torture is very clear that rape and sexual violence amount to torture and forms of cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment.
I think that's amazing. That's really incredible what you're saying, that committee calling them.
Yeah, so they've been called. That process, similar to the Committee on the Rights of the Child, that will be unfolding over the coming months. We will look forward to what their findings are. And then, unfortunately, tragically, these things are still happening all around the world, and the cover-ups are still happening. So we, sadly, expect to be returning to the ICC with more evidence of more recent violations at some point in the future.
I was interested that the term you're using is sexual violence rather than sexual abuse, mm-hmm. which I think is, mm-hmm. I'm sitting here, is a much, obviously, more appropriate and stronger term. But I'm wondering about when people start talking about this violence in that way, because I haven't really heard it used as frequently as you started to use it in this interview.
We were very clear starting out in our work with the Survivors Network that what's happening is sexual violence and rape often, and that abuse has a minimizing effect. It sort of tends to diminish and smooth off the edges of what it is we're actually talking about in the overwhelming majority of cases. So we've been very clear since we started working with SNAP that we're not going to buy into this minimizing language. And I should say that there have been commissions, a commission in Germany and a commission in Ireland, which found the same thing, that church officials were using these terms or using terms like touching or that sort of thing, and it has a very minimizing effect, and they were very clear. In Philadelphia, the grand jury was very clear, too, that what we're talking about is rape and violence.
I know that in the report you issued with SNAP and CCR a year ago, it listed several countries where sexual violence by clergy has been happening and documented, and the statistics listed said that roughly between 1981 and 2005, we may be approaching 100,000 cases. In the last year or so, are more facts coming in? Are more countries reporting?
I should say that figure is actually subsequent to that report. The Vatican actually, Vatican officials actually acknowledged a much higher number and said that the 100,000 figure is probably in the U.S. alone. And again,
oh my gosh.
Wow,
that's
yes.
like extraordinary.
And so, you know, I think what we're still just at the tip of the iceberg here, and because most of what we know has been it's been hard fought, you know, and we know it from civil cases here in the U.S., from commissions in other countries. And we're starting to see, like I said, there are three commissions operating now in Australia. And, you know, we'll learn more perhaps about the scale and scope there. But it's vast, and it's a system that has bred this kind of violence.
Pam, my last question is really an information question. I know the CCR website has a lot of material on this. The Vatican Report links to it, your materials. Can you just tell people how to go to that site and what to look for?
Sure. So it can be linked from our homepage, which is ccrjustice.org. You can go right to the landing page, which is ccrjustice.org/snap.
Pam Spies, it's always enlightening, depressing, but with some rays of hope to have you on. Thank you so much.
I mean, you know, you and SNAP and CCR, it's just been a remarkable few years in terms of bringing this issue up and hopefully making a big difference. So thank you.
Well, we appreciate your attention and coverage. And if I can just say that, you know, being with the Survivors Network folks when all of this was happening and for them to see the media coverage in the wake of the UN's report that finally validated everything they've been saying and fighting for, it's been an amazing moment for them. And so when you talk about rays of hope, that's been a big one.
When I see you out there, Pam, with the survivors holding pictures of what they looked like as children and their courage in coming forward like that, being present at those has just brought me to tears, and I'm sure everybody who's looked at that.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Thanks,
thank
Pam.
You.
Talk to you soon.
Great. Thank
Bye-bye.
You. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.